This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Nina Lanza. She's a scientist with Los Alamos National Laboratory's Space and Remote Sensing Group. She's part of a NASA program, Antarctic Search for Meteorites. She's a member of the ChemCam instrument team for the Curiosity Mars rover, and she just recently returned from Antarctica. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I imagine it's great to be here after being in a completely white, lifeless continent.
Yeah, so Antarctica only has life on the edges and the margins. So you'll see whales and seals and birds on the margins because that's where the open water is. But once you get into the interior where we were, there's nothing but blue glacier ice, white snow, and jagged mountains. So it's very otherworldly.
Yeah. What was it like? I mean, just the experience of going there. First of all, I imagine you did quite a bit of training.
Well, they trained us to do outdoor work while we were there. They select people based on their backgrounds, and they don't necessarily require that you've ever gone camping before. I've heard there was a person who went maybe 3 years ago, has never gone camping. Her first camping experience was on a glacier in the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. Although I don't know if I would do that. I feel like I'd want to like test out a tent before living in one for 5 weeks, which is what we did.
So what was it like? You arrived in Antarctica. You get there from, what, the tip of South America?
So we actually go in through Christchurch, New Zealand. And that's because McMurdo Station, which is the U.S. Base, is much closer to New Zealand than it is to South America. So we fly in on a military transport. Most people will actually have to take a boat. If you're a tourist, you have to pass through the Drake Passage, which is some of the roughest ocean in the world. But lucky me, I got to take a C-130.
And so then you get there with your team. How big was your team?
8 people, including me.
And what happens next?
So we arrive in McMurdo, and we need to get all of our gear ready. And so this is pretty straightforward because we have a lot of veterans on the team. One of our mountaineers has done this project for over 35 years, so he's pretty experienced. But what we end up doing is spending a lot of time after we have our equipment ready, we get our food ready for 40 days, and then we wait until the bush pilots can fly us into our remote field site because there are no runways, you know. So they have to... weather has to be good, and the snow conditions have to be good, and if they aren't good, for whatever reason, we are not flying. So we spent a lot of time getting up early, packing all of our stuff, and being ready to go, only be told that our flight was canceled.
Right.
So then we, you know, could go back to bed, but, you know, we'd already stripped all the sheets off of our bed, so.
And then you take a little plane eventually into the interior.
That's correct, yeah. So we take... there are 2 types of planes that we can take. One is a Twin Otter, and the other is a Basler. A Basler is slightly larger. It's a refitted DC-3, so it just has a longer cab, and we have to fit all of our equipment, including our skidoos. Each person has their own skidoo.
What's a skidoo?
It is like a snowmobile. That's okay. What most people would call it. Skidoo is a brand name, but, you know, I think in Arctic and Antarctic circles, we like to call them snow machines.
Right.
But they don't make snow. They just drive over them. So that's how we search for meteorites. It's really hard to do it on foot, of course. It's a big place. So we drive very slowly on skidoos. But skidoos are pretty large. If anyone's seen them, they're probably the size of a small motorcycle. And so fitting those onto these small planes is really tricky.
So 8 skidoos and 8 people.
Oh, no. We have 3 or 4 different transports. So it takes a long time. And one of them happening the first time is that 4 of us got out, set up our tents, and then waited. The weather got terrible. It got so windy that the plane could not return for maybe 4 days. And so half of our team was in McMurdo. The other half was 400 miles south in the Trans-Antarctic Mountains in the Miller Range. And we just sat in our tent listening to 60 mile an hour winds. That's what I measured it at. Which is incredible. I've never been in wind like that.
Were you scared?
You know, I didn't know enough to be scared. In retrospect, I should have been scared because people lose tents that way. People blow away in winds of that strength. I mean, it's not the record, but I just was like, oh, maybe this is normal. I hear it's windy in Antarctica.
How cold was it? I can't even imagine it.
So when I tell you the temperature, you're going to be like, oh, that's not that cold. But really, it's the wind that makes it cold. So I would say on average, the temperature, I had a little pocket thermometer, an anemometer. So I'd measure the wind speed and the temperature every day. It was generally around 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's cold.
I mean, it's pretty cold, but it's not that cold. I mean, I measured -8 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the lowest, you know. But I think when there's no wind and there's plenty of sun, it actually feels pretty reasonable. But as soon as that wind starts moving, it feels like somebody is like slicing your face. I mean, like you just don't want to expose any skin to that kind of wind. It's just so much colder than anything. And that's because those winds are coming from the center of the continent. And that's one of the reasons we actually search for meteorites in these places, is because you have places where, so maybe I'll tell you, maybe before telling about this wind, I can tell you about how we, why we look for meteorites.
Yeah,
in Antarctica.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah. So Antarctica doesn't have more meteorite falls than any other part of the Earth, but you know, 71% of the Earth's surface is covered by an ocean. So it's harder to find those meteorites because they've sunk to the bottom. So in Antarctica, first of all, you've got this beautiful white sheet of ice. So it's easier to see things, but this ice is also moving. So you can imagine the glacier on the continent is actually moving from the center of the continent out in all directions toward the ocean. And if it just hits the ocean, meteorite's going to fall in the ocean. But if the ice hits something like a mountain range, then it will slow down and sometimes even stop. And then these very strong winds from the center of the continent will start ablating the ice, removing the ice, because the ice isn't moving. And so every rock that ever fell from space into that glacier that moved along will then become exposed. And then they're just there on the surface waiting for us to pick them up. So, of course, we look in areas that have these very strong winds.
Right. Now, are we talking about meteorites that fell a long time ago or that fell recently?
So it's hard to know exactly how long some of these meteorites have been here. Certainly we know the rate of movement of these glaciers, you know, pretty well. So many of these have been there for thousands and thousands of years, but we don't know, you know, it could have fallen yesterday, and, you know, there would be no way for us to really know in most cases.
Right. For our listeners, explain what a meteor is, what a meteorite is.
Sure. Right. So these are really just different names for the same rock in a different place. So when we talk about meteors, as in a meteor shower, we're talking about little pieces of rock that are falling into the atmosphere and making oftentimes a bright light that we can see from the ground.
Where do they come from?
Those just come from our solar system. They are frequently the leftovers of the building blocks. You know, when our planets were formed, there's still a bunch of other junk out there that's just in orbit around the sun too, and sometimes its orbit intersects with the Earth's orbit and then it falls to the ground here. So sometimes, you know, we'll go through, you know, a cloud of this material, little tiny rocks. And most of those things will not make it to the ground. They will heat up, they'll burn up, we'll see that beautiful meteor shower, and that's it. But some of them are bigger, and so they'll make a bright light, and some part of that rock is actually going to make it to the ground. And once a meteor touches the ground, then we call it a meteorite.
And how often do we have a sense of how many of these fall every day, every year, whatever, on planet Earth?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so there are definitely monitoring programs. So we can see that there's thousands of pieces of space rocks that are always falling. I actually don't know the answer to that. That's a great question. But it's quite a bit. Most of those materials, however, are, you know, the size of a sand grain. You know, they're very, very small.
Right.
So the larger materials are more rare. So the larger the meteorite, you know, the less likely it is to run into us, because there's more small materials in the solar system than there are large materials.
Now, do meteorites also fall onto the moon or other planets?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, there are meteorites falling on other planets as we speak. In fact, the Curiosity rover, which I work on, as you mentioned, has encountered a meteorite. We drove past one of these rocks. We're like, wow, that's a metallic meteorite. You know, it's certainly very distinctive looking. So at the time, I think it was a little too far, and we weren't able to analyze it. But we definitely took some beautiful pictures of them. So we don't know where that one came from. But certainly there are meteorites falling on other planets all the time.
When you have a sample of meteorites, let's say, I mean, I've only, I think, seen them in Natural History Museum or something like that. But let's say you've got meteorites picked up from all over the Earth. how much variability is there in what they're actually made of?
Yes, most so meteorites that fall over the Earth are a sampling of what's in the solar system. So typically you're not going to find different meteorites in different places, except that, you know, it's if they fall into the ocean, they'll just dissolve more easily.
Right, but I mean, like, if you've got 100 meteorites, are they all made of the same thing, or are they all made of different kinds of minerals?
So 85, if you had 100 meteorites that were a perfect sample, 85 of them would be what we call ordinary chondrites. And so those are the basic building blocks of the solar system. They're called chondrites because they are filled with little round grains that are called chondrules. So these are materials that were, you know, flash melted but not very hot in the early formation of our solar system and our planets. So these are materials that, you know, were heated a little bit but never incorporated into a bigger body. So that comprises most of the meteorites that we're going to find. And that's just because that's most of the stuff that's floating around. But some other percentage of those, you know, the materials that we find are actually from other larger bodies. So we found meteorites from the Moon, from Mars, and the asteroid Vesta, which actually we just visited as part of the Dawn mission, which we sent an orbiter there. So those are materials that we know came from a larger body because they don't have these chondrules in them. They actually are, you know, it's like, you know, the Earth is a differentiated body. It's so massive that, you know, when, you know, all these materials came together, all the heavy stuff eventually fell to the middle, which is why the Earth has a core, a metal core. That's the heaviest stuff. And the lightest stuff is floating on the surface. That's a differentiated body. And so we can tell immediately if a meteorite came from a differentiated body because it doesn't have these chondrules in it. And there's actually a really specific type of differentiated body meteorite that we found that's so exciting. It's called the palisite. And this comes from a very specific place in a large body. It's the core mantle boundary. So these are beautiful. You can find jewelry made out of these. This sort of this metal matrix with these golden crystals of olivine embedded in them. And they're just so gorgeous. And they're so rare. They're incredibly rare because they come from this very specific place in a larger body. And we actually found two of those this season, which is incredible. You know,
where did you find them?
Well, they were just out in the ice with all the other meteorites.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
So let's go back to Antarctica. You're driving around on your little skidoo, and we're talking to scientist Nina Lanza from Los Alamos National Laboratory and the Antarctic Search for Meteorites program of NASA. You're driving around on your skidoo, and what, you see something dark?
That's right. So we drive in a formation, so we drive in a line. And there are two people on the ends making sure that we're spaced appropriately. So we're not that close to each other. And so we kind of drive in a curve. You can imagine it like the people on the ends are a little bit in front and the people in the middle a little bit behind. And that's just so we can see each other. And we're scanning. We're scanning for rocks. And anytime you see a rock, you want to stop and look at it. Now, there are places where there are a lot of rocks, and they aren't all space rocks. And so
I was going to say, some of them are space rocks, some of them aren't. Where do the non-space, like the terrestrial Earth rocks, come from?
Yeah, they come from Antarctica. So glaciers are a very powerful force for erosion. Ice can just scour rocks off the sides of mountains. And these rocks are essentially being torn from the continent and incorporated into the glacier, and then they'll travel along, and then a meteorite will fall in, add to the mix, you know, but so it's very unsorted material sometimes. So sometimes, you know, you're faced with thousands of rocks, most of which are not from space. And those are a hard day.
So you are going along, and sometimes you find terrestrial rocks, sometimes you find meteors or meteorites. What's the ratio? I mean, is it rare to find a meteorite in a day?
Oh, not at all. There's so many meteorites there just because these glaciers are acting to concentrate the meteorites in this one place. I think I read somewhere that ANSMET, this project, has found in previous seasons, you know, one meteorite per square meter.
Oh my goodness.
That's a lot of meteorites. And I know that there was one location where we found 92 meteorites in one day. And I mean, it's just one place. It was probably the size of the Santa Fe Baking Company. Like, there were just so many in one location.
And what was the average size of them?
Most of them are going to be probably, you know, maybe like an inch in diameter or something like that. But there are some much larger ones. We found this big one that was the size of, I don't know, maybe a football or a small soccer ball. It was really heavy. It was an ordinary chondrite, but it was huge. We all got our picture taken with it.
And then you put them on your vehicle, you go home to your tent, and at the end of what, you were out there for what, a week and a half or something like that?
So we lived out there for 5 weeks.
5 weeks?
5 weeks, living in tents.
It's at 0 degrees and blowing
That's
wind.
Right, yep. It was.
How did you stay warm?
Well, we have really good gear. We get U.S. government issued clothing in Christchurch, New Zealand. We don't even get on the plane before they give us what we call our big red jackets. These are these very warm parkas that are essentially like wearing a sleeping bag. So it's really important, of course, to have the right gear when you go there.
And do you have like an ice outhouse or something?
Oh, no, no. We have a bucket in what we call the poo tent. I know. Everyone wants to know. So, yeah.
One can't help but wonder.
Well, these are the practical things. When you go traveling places, you know, you want to know, where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to eat? Where am I going to pee?
Right.
So, because Antarctica is this pristine wilderness, it's part of the Antarctic Treaty that every country that has a base there has signed, you cannot leave human waste out there, which I agree with, you know. And just to, not to mention, I mean, that's sort of, you know, you're selling this beautiful wilderness. So we pee into bottles. For women, this is a little more tricky. We use female urinary directors. And then if you have to poo, then we have a tent that's very luxurious. We have a bucket with like a styrofoam toilet seat on it, and some scented candles and some reading material like the New Yorker. We had a very old New Yorker. And, you know, it's almost like home, except that the floor is made of ice and the walls are shaking.
And are you able to bathe at all?
I mean, some people try. I think it's tricky. I mean, luckily these days there are a lot of different kinds of body wipes, so that can help you from being rank. But I did not wash my hair for 5 weeks while I was out there. It actually wasn't that bad. You know, people worry about it. I'm like, it really isn't that bad. And especially when it's cold, you know, you don't smell that bad when it's cold.
Right.
Because, you know, microbes don't thrive in that environment either.
What was the hardest part of actually being in Antarctica for you?
So people, you know, imagine, you know, it's really hard to be cold. It's hard to live outside for that long, you know, 5 weeks.
But that, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that was very simple, but those things did not bother me at all. I wasn't really bothered by the cold. We have great equipment, you know, and living outside was actually kind of fun. But I think that the isolation is hard to understand until you're there. And, you know, you're in a place where there is literally no other living creatures except for your 7 teammates. Sometimes you see the bush pilots, you know. They're different, but you really are there with the same people, and they're wonderful people. These people are great people to get to know, and you have a lot of time to get to know each other, but it's not the same as being with your, you know, usual support network, you know, your spouse or your friends, your family. Those people are so far away, and you can't talk to them very much, and I really was surprised by how acutely I felt that after a while, you know, just to be really well, to be known by somebody who's known you for a long time. And again, it's not that anybody on the trip was terrible. Everyone was really excellent and so fascinating. You know, you don't get on a trip like this without being that
yeah.
guy, but being away from home.
Did you have existential dread? Like, did you get up in the middle of the night and write in your journal kind of thing? I mean,
well, I did get up in the middle of the night only because I was really confused about what time it was.
Yeah.
I actually had to train myself to look at my clock. I actually didn't dream at all in Antarctica, which is amazing because I have very vivid dreams at home. And I just did not dream at all. I think I can't remember a single dream. So it was very much like my mind was much more blank in some ways because you don't have any distractions. You don't have internet, you know.
Right.
You don't have, I mean, you kind of have TV. We have some, you know, laptops, but
do you dream about it now, like your experience there? Do you dream about ice and that
yeah,
landscape?
I feel like the color of my dreams, what I've noticed, like the color of Antarctica is just this incredible blue. It's so hard to describe. It's almost like the sky, but it's that color of this ice, this glacial ice, and the colors, it's just the blue and the white. Sometimes you can't tell the difference between the ground and the sky. And I've never seen that anywhere else. And I've climbed on other glaciers. It's just that color is still in my mind. I feel like I'm still dreaming in light blue.
Can you look at it directly, or do you always have to have protective glasses on?
It's very bright. I would never leave the tent without eye protection. I mean, you won't burn your eyes immediately or something. But you have to remember there's also an ozone hole over Antarctica, so the UV is pretty strong and the sun's bright anyway. And imagine, like, you know, as you're trying to go skiing at a ski resort without any goggles, it's really bright. So we always use very dark glasses.
Okay, so then after 5 weeks of collecting, you've got a big and heavy stash of stuff.
That's right.
And then airplanes come for you. Are you in radio contact with the regular world during those 5 weeks?
So we must be in contact with McMurdo Operations. We call that MAC Ops. We need to check in with them at designated times every day. If we don't do that, within 5 minutes, they're going to start mustering search and rescue, because it's very, you know, this is not a place where there's a lot of margin for error. If you are injured or hurt, every second counts. So we do stay in contact with McMurdo Station. We also did have satellite phones. Of course, you know, not great connection, not terrible, but not great. And we were very busy. So, you know, I could call home, but we were living on New Zealand time, which is something like 18 hours ahead of New Mexico. So we were across the international dateline. So actually calling home meant that I had to wake up early, and much earlier than I normally want to do. Not that it matters, because, you know, the sun is always up in the summer, never set. So, you know, it's a little bit arbitrary, but still. So because we were very busy, you know, there's not a lot of time for, you know, long in-depth conversations.
Did you lose your circadian rhythms at all?
Yeah, I found it to be deeply confusing. I mean, I knew kind of what time it was because of what direction the sun was shining. But I never slept as well. I really am enjoying having darkness again. You know?
Yeah.
It still was an incredible, I mean, it's an incredible experience, because it's very, again, otherworldly. You know, that's not like a thing that most people experience. So to have light like that all the time, I just got kind of off kilter.
We're talking to scientist Nina Lanza. So why are we searching for meteorites in the first place? What, you get home with this stuff, what do you do with it? What does it tell you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the meteorites that we are recovering are represent samples from bodies that we've never gone to. Like, NASA hasn't done sample return missions except for a very few places. So we have, you know, materials from the moon that we went and collected. We have materials from the asteroid Itokawa, and we have materials from the comet Vilt 2. Those are the only places we've gone to get materials. We've never done sample return from Mars. We've never done sample return from Vesta. That's that asteroid I was telling you about. So these materials allow us to do sample return from thousands and thousands of bodies within the solar system without going anywhere. I mean, we had to go to Antarctica.
Going to Antarctica, yeah.
But that's still, like, you know, our backyard. It's not mounting a space mission and going to do sample return, which is much more difficult and more expensive. So this is a really cost-effective way for us to explore the solar system without going anywhere.
Now, when you have all these materials, are there the same kinds of rocks somewhere on planet Earth? Like, do these materials exist if you, say, dig deep enough?
No, ordinary chondrites represent materials that have never been heated or been part of this larger body. So, no, we don't. The Earth used to be made of ordinary chondrite, and now it's not. Now it's a differentiated body. So there's nothing like that that we can get on the Earth.
So they're deeply foreign. I mean, they're really another material. What do they tell you?
Well, they can tell us a lot. First, they can tell us, you know, some of these, you know, older meteorites, these chondrites, they tell us about what were the building blocks of the solar system. And in particular, you know, what were the organics, you know, what are the organic molecules that were available to, you know, in the early solar system? How much water was there? Where did that water go? That tells us something about how does a solar system form, and then how do, you know, the basic building blocks of life move around the solar system? How are they incorporated into planets? How much are left? You know, that those are really fundamental questions about the origin, our origins from meteorites. So that's what the older meteorites can tell us, these undifferentiated ones. But even these newer ones, I mean, they can tell us things about planets that we could never learn otherwise. You know, I work on a Mars mission, and we have so much information about Mars from our rovers, from our orbiting satellites, but we only have 130-something rocks in our hands here on Earth that we've ever been able to study. And you can just do so much. You can learn so much as a geologist. I like having that rock in my hand. I can do many different types of analyses. I can repeat analyses. You can't do that on Mars. You have our rovers are amazing, but they only have so many instruments. And maybe sometimes you do an analysis, you're like, oh, well, what about this? And we didn't bring that instrument. And there's nothing we can do about it, you know? So that question will always be unanswered. But that's not true for rocks that we have in our hands. So we can learn so much more about these planets by actually having these samples. And especially since we haven't done sample return. I mean, these are then priceless for science.
Can you tell where each one comes from?
Not just from looking at it. There are ones where you can suspect because we've seen, the ones we found actually some pieces of the asteroid Vesta on this trip, and we could tell that only because they have a very distinctive appearance. But other meteorites, you can say, I know this is a chondrule filled meteorite, this one is an achondrite, but it's very hard sometimes to know where something came from, what its parent body was, until you get into the laboratory and then you look at its chemical composition.
And then you can tell.
And then we have a much better chance of telling. I mean, some of these meteorites, right? And I told you about the palisites. Those came from bodies that experienced a collision that was so large that those bodies don't exist anymore. That's why we have a piece of the core mantle boundary, right? It doesn't exist, so we can't necessarily connect that to a body in the solar system that exists anymore, but it's something that used to exist. So we can start putting together the story by looking at other meteorites and say, hey, does this match this one chemically? Does this match this one? We have this huge catalog of meteorites that we can start, putting together like a puzzle.
Are there any other, what we're talking about is science, like these huge questions, origins of the universe, the building blocks of how life formed, things like that. Are there other much more sort of practical uses for them? The reason I ask is because I read a book in which somebody was talking about the business of asteroid mining and things like that. Do people use them for industrial purposes? I mean, you mentioned that some of them are beautiful. They make stuff
out of them. That's right. Most of the meteorites that we're going to find are not going to be big enough for any kind of industrial purpose. So, right, people want to mine asteroids because they represent something that's huge. But these materials that we're getting, they're not huge. There's just not a lot of mass. So they're not probably practical for any industrial application. But I would say, certainly people can wear them as pretty jewelry. It's always nice to have a piece of space.
Do you do that?
I actually don't have any, I shouldn't say any. I do have like one meteorite necklace, but I've changed my mind about it now that I've actually gone to collect these materials, understanding how rare they are, how difficult it is to obtain them. I actually feel like I want those materials to be used for science, even though they're so beautiful. If somebody gave me a palisite necklace, it would be very, very hard for me to say no. It has a great story and is incredibly beautiful. But I do, understanding now just how rare those materials are, I feel less good about using it for decoration. And that's why people always ask, oh, did you bring me a meteorite from Antarctica? I did not bring anyone a meteorite.
Right.
Because that would be, even if no one found out, I would still, that would be taking away material that is just, that would teach us something about our universe and our solar system. And I don't want to do that. I want to know more. I want to know more about it.
I mean, it's the way people talk about archaeological sites.
Right, I'm sure. Right, yeah, if you kept an arrowhead, like, who's going to know? But, first of all, that's now your secret arrowhead. Don't tell anyone. And you've just taken away from the knowledge that we could have gained.
Exactly.
And that's really important.
You are with Los Alamos National Laboratory. It's called the Space and Remote Sensing Group. We talked to you a couple of years ago about the Curiosity rover on Mars and what was going there. And I'll never forget you talked about how someday you would like to actually go to Mars. But when you were old enough to think, I've lived enough just in case I don't come back. I was like, really? But so what is this all about with respect to Los Alamos? Why is Los Alamos doing this kind of research?
Sure, yeah. A lot of times people wonder about that, right? Because it's not a logical connection in most people's minds. But you know, we at Los Alamos actually have a long history of doing space exploration. I think we've launched something like 500 different space instruments. I mean, that's a lot. That's a long history of doing space research. And certainly the research, my main, you know, my day job is working on the rover on the ChemCam instrument, which was built at Los Alamos. And we operate that. We're operating it today to get data from Mars. So this ANSMET work that I've been doing, I think, is a really logical extension of the, all that space research that we already do at Los Alamos that people aren't always aware of.
Do you still hope to go to Mars?
Absolutely. Many of your listeners will know that NASA just had another call for astronauts. I threw in my hat into the ring again. We'll see. This was a record number of people applying. It was about 18,000 people, which is super great. And NASA is heading now in the direction of sending people to Mars. That's sort of the next step on the horizon. So,
what are the challenges? I mean, there's so many challenges in getting to Mars, but what would it take to actually survive the trip?
So you'd want to make it as fast as possible. We send our spacecraft on a little bit of a slow trajectory because, you know, they don't mind being out in space alone for 8.5 months as much as people do. But a big problem would be, you know, space weather and just the radiation environment. Once we're outside of this very protective magnetic field of the Earth, you know, there are a lot more energetic particles out there, and that's a hard problem to solve.
How do you protect from those?
Well, it's a longstanding issue in human spaceflight. So, you know, you can only put so much shielding on people before your spacecraft is just so heavy. It's not flyable. So the trick is going to be, I think, to go faster. And we can go faster. It just takes more energy. So, you know, it's a mass versus speed problem. And I'm sure there are plenty of people working on optimizing that for humans. But I think that's probably going to be, at least in the foreseeable future, that's going to be how we overcome that particular hurdle.
So maybe the first man on Mars will be a woman.
That's right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we often use the term manned mission, but I think it would be better to say a human mission or a crewed mission, because we are just sending a crew, and that could be men and women, and it should be.
Nina Lanza is a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. She's a geologist. She's with the Space and Remote Sensing Group. And she just got home from Antarctica with the NASA program Antarctic Search for Meteorites. She's part of the ChemCam instrument team for the Curiosity rover on Mars. Thank you so much for being with us, and come back soon and give us some updates.
Great. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.